Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sarah from Cheltenham, and you are listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, does social media bring positivity or negativity to your life? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer,
hello,
and a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from...
Well, we're talking everything from Sarah from Cheltenham's question, does social media bring positivity or negativity to your life? Negativity. Thanks for writing in, Sarah.
Well, first of all, shout out everybody from the Gloucestershire crew. Thank you, Sarah, for your question. I think the best quote is the one I heard from Chris Rock, where he said, like, you know, fame and profile is very similar to fire in that it can keep your house warm and cook your food, but it can also burn your house down and horrifically scar you. And I feel like social media is very similar. It's got a lot of positivity, gives a lot of visibility to spaces and places and people you wouldn't normally hear from. It's definitely democratized the voices of people online. But at the same time, it's still a very early technology, and we're not sure how severely it can burn us or at what degree it can burn us to.
Very good answer, Dane. And if you, like Sarah from Cheltenham, want to ask a question, why don't you get in touch with us on social media? And suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely. No question is too big, too small, highbrow, lowbrow, positive or negative. And if you do like the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify, and you'll never miss an episode. You can find us on all platforms, and you'll be able to hear the very special questions being asked and answered by our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is a journalist, presenter, and screenwriter, an all-round good guy. He presented on T4, on Tool Academy, Freshly Squeezed, E4 Music, and the 2012 Paralympic coverage, to name a few of his plaudits and credits. He has also written for The Observer, The Evening Standard, and The Huffington Post, as well as being a BBC presenter for the quiz show Impossible. He can now be found on the airwaves of BBC Radio 5 Breakfast, usually alongside Rachel Burden. And he has even gone to the trouble to actively help and support my career, and also got me a few nice t-shirts and jumpers from Percival. And I want to thank him personally for that. Please
That's
welcome
no problem.
To the show, Mr. Rick Edwards.
That is, I always put that at the very top of my CV. I always build to the stuff that I've done for you, Dane.
I had no idea about this bromance. Where's this fucking, get this fucking choir over these 180 odd episodes, Dane?
Howard, the way a bromance survives is if you don't go too public with it. That's the thing about social media. Once people know, you know, who you're linked to, then, you know, they can always start hacking away at that union. And I always wanted to preserve that with Rick. So also, Rick was worried that he wouldn't be getting any flowers on this episode. And I want you to know, Rick, that we are a digital florist, if nothing else, on this podcast. We like to give plaudits to those who deserve it, and in large heaps.
And that is exactly why I'm here. I'm here because I like you, Dane, and I'm here because I want the digital flowers.
I was trying to think
about when we first met. Was it on Safe Word? Would it have been Safe Word?
Yeah, I think it might have been Safe Word. Yeah,
which is quite a fun show that I don't think you'd be able to do now. It feels a bit mean, doesn't it?
I think it'd be way too volatile because a large part of it was taken over someone's social media.
Yeah.
The little prank here and there could leave people open for a lot of backlash moving forward.
There's a lot of Russian bots already doing it for certain people.
Well, there you
anyway,
go. So maybe it would work maybe a bit too well. But I
Do you think Russia today were watching Safe Word and they were like, "This is good, actually. This is a good idea. We could have some fun with this."
We never know.
Vladimir, watch this.
Exactly. How well do we know the exact producers?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to know what he made of Gemma Collins for starters.
I'm sure they were like, if we were able to get her to defect, she'd be an amazing asset. But luckily for us, Gemma's still on our side.
She's stuck with us. Yeah.
Yeah. And Gemma Collins, maybe she's the person that will be able to reunite NATO in the face of this conflict with Russia and Ukraine. Who knows? Stranger things have happened.
Yeah, well, okay, good luck to everyone in a world where that's possible, but yeah.
I just want you to name one stranger thing than Gemma Collins sorting out everything between Russia and Ukraine and NATO.
That's true, yeah.
Listen, I was wondering you write in. It's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as the format of this show dictates, mate?
Absolutely. Mr. Rick Edwards is our very esteemed guest. We'd like to invite you to ask the first question, which would be any question you'd like, which we'd like to discuss with you for about 15 minutes or some change. Yeah. Then my producer friend and co-host, Howard Cohen, would like to pose a question to you to discuss for the same amount of time. Uh-huh. And then keeping up with tradition, I'd like to pose a question to you that we could discuss for about 15 minutes. And with our remaining time, we'd love for you to tell our viewers and listeners where they can hear about your good works, past, present and future.
Yeah,
how does that sound?
Yeah, well, it sounds perfect to me. So my question is one that I've sort of been mulling over for a few years now, and it is meritocracy, the concept of meritocracy, overrated? Now, I can expand upon that if you'd like.
Please, or you expand can expand where you've
always
been inspired.
Always. So I think that the idea of meritocracy, and certainly for me when I was growing up, was a very seductive one. So in the sort of simplest terms, it kind of says, you know, do you want to live in a society where your background, your gender, your race, your class, none of that really, really matters. It's just like you will get as far in life as your hard work and talent dictates. Uh-huh. And that's quite a sort of, oh, sorry, I think my coffee machine is turning itself off. That is my fault, but also I don't know how to stop it. It just sort of does it randomly. So I'll pick up from that.
I feel like if it can hear you, just make sure
to look forward to for
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
My advice would be for any automated device nowadays, just make sure you punctuate your sentences with please and thank you, because when the revolution comes, they'll remember that you were pleasant to them. Yeah. So
it's a good point, actually. Thank you, coffee machine. Appreciate that. Yeah. So you kind of have this idea, and I think particularly for me, I was really enamored with it because I thought, well, yeah, that seems like a really fair system, and a good thing to strive for. And wouldn't it be nice to imagine that that was the way that everything works? And it is an idea that has been pushed at various points in our recent history, in the US's recent history. Tony Blair talked about it just before he was elected in, I think, in 1996. And it's only, fairly recently that I've started to think, I'm not sure that A, meritocracy is workable. It's sort of in the abstract. Or B, that it is working at all in our societies at the moment. And I think
can
it's
I
actually,
you,
yeah.
Can I ask you, Rick, do you feel what you've achieved in your career has been based on merit?
Well, this is the thing. So it's quite reassuring to think yes. And the more that I've considered it, I think no. I think I've got lucky in all sorts of different ways. And that's really fine, but I don't think most people accept that.
Because, when you say luck, is it not luck as in like my family member got me this job?
No. There's levels of luck, isn't there? And also, like, okay, so this is quite a fundamental question, but let's say that I'm good at exams, and as it happens, I am good at exams now. Is that lucky? Well, yeah, because I haven't done anything to, like, I don't deserve to be good at exams. I just happens to be good at exams. And there's lots of factors that have sort of fed into that, but none of them are anything to do with my sort of character or work.
Oh, man, it's so fascinating. Dane, you must have. I can see Dane brewing up some.
Yeah, yeah.
Some
is why I really would love to hear Dane sort of.
I've got a lot of things
this.
To add to it. I think Dane's going to go first.
No, go ahead, because I'm that's interesting. So I think it fits into a number
question,
of different
I question it all
well.
The time, Rick. You know, like, I look at my life now, and as Dane knows, comparatively to when he met me, I live a happy life. I can actually say that out loud in public on a book. life's, I like my life. It's decent now. And that does come down, potentially come down to my work, which in a lot of cases will not be the defining thing of your happiness. There is, and I don't know, I'd love to know the statistics on how many people derive their happiness from their work. I imagine that percentage is incredibly low.
Because I think that the dignity that we sort of confer on work, certain types of work anyway, has been eroded with time. I think that, you know, certain sorts of work are put in this quite privileged position, and most work isn't. With some sort of notable exceptions. And that in itself, I think, is probably a problem.
I would often, you know, I sometimes meet people at the start of their career, they'll ask me about mine and the stuff I've done in my career. And I often will talk about it in a way that does sound, like it's been a merit. It's been on merit. Like some of the stories of my career are like, so like when everyone went home, I got the cameras out and started filming shit. And that's what got me out of the job that I had at the start, which I didn't want to do for very long because it was burning DVDs, which was miserable. Like, that sounds like it's a meritocracy, right? I forced my way out. But like, I often, you know, and in the way that you're talking about, like, is it just lucky that I was driven and motivated? You know, but in some ways, Dane, don't you make your own luck? Don't you make your own luck in this world?
Can I make one?
You can make as much as you want.
I'm going to make one more point just to sort of throw in. Well, two actually. Sorry. One is, I think there is also an issue that you can find lots of outlier anecdotal examples of people who have done extraordinary things from sort of, you know, quite sort of lowly beginnings. And so it's the sort of the Alan Sugars is your classic. And I think it quite often it tends to be a bit gendered. So Alan Sugar is like boy done good. And certainly previously, I think sort of aspirational women aren't afforded the same amount of respect. But that's probably, we probably don't want to go into that now. But that, I do think that's a factor. The other thing, and that then gets held up by the people who sort of want to maintain this idea that meritocracy is doing a good job. They point to these people and they say, look, it's working. And I think it doesn't mean it's working. You're always going to find some people who've done some extraordinary things. That doesn't tell you that systemically meritocracy is functioning in the way that you want it to, or indeed that it's a good thing anyway.
It's cool. I mean, I think it's a really good question. I think for me, the short answer would be that I don't necessarily think that meritocracy is overrated, but I definitely take what you say in terms of like, I believe obviously there needs to be the opportunity to realize meritocracy for it to work effectively. So we were speaking about like luck before, and you know, some people define luck as opportunity met with preparation.
That's it.
And so while meritocratically you can prove or justify your position to exploit or realize an opportunity, because that's not always offered to everybody, we don't really get to see a ubiquitous landscape of meritocracy to see how well it works. I think it's also very important to contextualize questions when we're talking about like occupation or success, particularly monetary success, within throughout the lens of like capitalism, because we were speaking about like certain types of jobs before, and I think one of the negative facets of capitalism, among many, is the occupational hierarchy we tend to have in our society. So, you know, for example, I think that there is meritocracy must exist in like a industry like sanitation or like sewage treatment. There are some people that have much more insight in terms of being able to treat sewage better than others. But because we have an hierarchy where that job and that industry is probably less well regarded than something like banking and finance, then true meritocracy doesn't really get to take place there, because we don't emphasize or celebrate someone having a superior aptitude within that particular industry. And I think that can kind of be a problem as well. I think, as you said, I think the hardest thing is to look at the effect of meritocracy is that people will take individual or anecdotal examples of meritocracy working, and then use that to describe the entire industry as working in the same way, which I don't necessarily agree with. So, like, you know, valid example being like an Alan Sugar. Obviously, he's had a lot of monetary success and had more humble beginnings. But in order for that prosperity to take place, we have to understand that capitalism works as a zero-sum game. And he would inevitably have to fuck people over or deprive other people of a similar opportunity in order for him to kind of realize or maintain his position. An example could just be the show that he's on himself, the format of The Apprentice. It's kind of paradoxical in itself, in that one of the tenets of you being an entrepreneur is that you don't necessarily have to concede or cede under someone else's authority or guidance if you truly believe you have a business model that's going to work. And we've seen examples of that, whether it's like people who have maybe left The Apprentice and gone on to have success, like, you know, someone like Tim Campbell, who has his own business, or in instances of like Dragon's Den, for example, where the dragons, even though they are meritocratically selected because of their superior business prowess or acumen, they may not be able to identify a prosperous business based on their own experience. So I feel like in that instance, meritocracy is somewhat stunted because I guess the judgment of merit can be so subjective.
Also, I think it's really interesting your point about, you know, Alan Sugar succeeding presumably means that some other people are not succeeding. And that, I think fundamentally, that might be my principal objection, even to a functioning meritocracy, is it effectively says, okay, everyone start at the same level, great, and then see how far you get, see how far up the ladder, however you want to define the ladder, you can get. Doesn't say anything about the separation of the rungs, like the amount of inequality that you can end up with there.
Yeah.
And also think about, if you believe that you live in an entirely meritocratic society and you end up not doing very well, the sort of the philosophy of it tells you that's your fault.
Yeah.
Because exactly. You didn't have the talent, you didn't put in the hard work, and it's all on you. It puts it on the individual. And I think that's maybe the most damaging aspect of it, I think.
Yeah. And the most disingenuous part about it, because like a large part of people, when they are able to transcend into positions of power or positions of success, any high echelon of society, part of the benefits of that is that you, in many cases, will be able to enjoy or exploit some form of impunity from the other, hurdles that other people who are also aspiring to meritocratically kind of transcend their situation as well. So a perfect example being Rishi Sunak, for example, has now gone from working class beginnings to now ascending to the office of being the prime minister. However, he's also sat on the board of Goldman Sachs and been able to orchestrate a massive banker bailout for them, which has meant that anybody else who would be in a similar position or came from a similar background now, due to a number of machinations which they were involved with, wouldn't be able to realize that same position, because they'd have to pay their taxes along the way or pay for their tuition along the way, or, you know, not be privy to a banker's bailout, which is one of the largest acts of socialism, to pay out a capitalist institution that we've ever seen in recorded history. So we would never be able to realize meritocracy in that respect. So in the same way that, like, historically, in sports and entertainment, because they were historically segregated, we would have never been able to really see true meritocracy in that particular fashion. And I think that issue in terms of meritocracy kind of, it permeates every aspect of our society. And as I said, because it's, really, we discuss it really through the lens of capitalism, we never actually truly see it.
Well, and I would say that one thing that I don't like about it is the feeling that you are defined by it. You know, you can be constantly defined by it, and in reality, every individual person can be responsible for their own actions. I know it doesn't mean that everyone is on the same playing field, but as we've just discussed, being on the same playing field doesn't define your future. And so I think one thing that does define a lot of people's lives is inaction. In being inactive, you two people I'm talking to now, I would not describe as inactive. You've been active and pursued stuff in your life, and unfortunately, not everyone has that in them. And therefore,
I don't think that's necessarily something that is a center of the brain or the human complex that can atrophy necessarily. I think a perfect example being maybe the relative inaction of people in this part of the world in how in terms of they react to climatological crisis.
Mm.
It's going to be very different to a developing country because of just the lack of visibility. In the West, where essentially we live what I refer to as like almost having a landfill lifestyle, in that we don't necessarily have an infrastructure which lends to climatological responsibility any more than a developing country. What we do have is an infrastructure that allows us to remain oblivious to the severity of the crisis, because when you throw shit away, that just goes to a landfill and you don't have to see it. So the impetus for you to be involved or practically involve yourself in being more ecologically conscious is no longer your problem necessarily. All you've got to do is put your rubbish in the right color-coded dustbins and you don't have to give it any more regard. And I think, you know, in terms of how I was saying is that, you know, some people aren't necessarily active. Part of that, I think there's a nature versus nurture discussion about that as well. And it's the same one that involves meritocracy, because I think there's a distinction. I think, hard professor whose name I don't recall, but I did occupational psychology at uni and it was discussing the difference between aptitude and achievement, and your aptitude being like your natural knack for grabbing something and grasping an idea or concept, whereas achievement is that you can be put in a position where there may be a curriculum, and by passing these various stages, you can become a success. And you can regard both of those as necessarily meritocratic, because as I said, if you're lucky enough to be in a position where you can do well and you apply yourself and you do well, you could argue that's meritocratic. So people use examples of like someone like Frank Lampard, grew up in a system of football and has been able to become one of the best midfielders of his generation. Whereas someone like Wayne Rooney grew up playing in a park or playing with jumpers for goalposts and they still realized the same position. But you'd argue that both of them meritocratically, because they're in an industry where less than 1% of the participants become a success, they're both two schools of meritocracy, but aren't exactly the same. But I think, again, it's definitely a nature versus nurture thing where, as I say, it's like, it's very hard to really determine the efficacy of meritocracy because we very rarely see it being acted out fully.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the problem, is that like, I don't necessarily think that meritocracy is overrated. I just think it's because of the fact that very rarely do we get to see it acted out, particularly within a capitalist society, but where everyone's going to offer the opportunity.
But if I did offer you a pure meritocracy, would you be comfortable with the level of inequality that would emerge sort of inevitably?
I would, but then I guess that might be because ideologically I'm a socialist, and I think part of being meritocratic would still involve social responsibility, because we're a species. So, for example, it's like if I, you know, make loads of money from comedy, the idea that I may pay into a tax base which provides for other people for whatever environmental or biological factors doesn't allow them to do the same things as I do, they can still be empowered to realize their merit. And I think I say that because I think everyone being able to realize their meritocratic potential benefits society overall. If anyone can have the opportunity to be the best they can be, then, you know, I think that betters everyone else ultimately to an extent. But I think obviously you need to provide those conditions.
But I guess what you're saying is that from a socialist point of view, that you'd let the meritocracy run in its pure form. You'd sort of end up with the inequality, and then you would do some redistribution to reduce the inequality. So then you see what I mean? That's not a pure meritocracy. You've got to overlay something.
But
you feel comfortable with it.
I mean, maybe it's because I think when we talk about meritocracy, I think people talk about individual merit. And that's why I don't necessarily believe that. I think that no one does it by themselves, and there's be a number of interdependent relationships at various stages of your career that allows you to do it. Like you could be a very fast runner, but you probably need a trainer or someone who goes to the trouble of building a track, or someone that designs spikes. All of these all interdependent examples of someone being meritocratic will combine to realize your potential. So I think the issue is that it's effective, but it's because we don't need to look at meritocracy as a function of your individual merit. I think that everyone should be able to effectively have an interdependent display of their skills or attributes, but also understand that, you know, you realizing that is the culmination of the work that's done before you. Because even on a genetic level, really, if you're born with the natural ability to do stuff as well, that's come from a long genetic lineage of other people through evolution and natural selection that put you in a position to achieve as well.
Yeah, and there's a great example. I'll plug a book, actually, because this is such a... I think we could sort of talk about this for probably a day and still have more to talk about. But there's a really good book by a philosopher called Michael J. Sandel called The Tyranny of Merit, who talks about all of this stuff. And it's really, really fascinating. I think you both like it. And he gives the example of the sort of the luck of LeBron James. And he says, obviously, LeBron James is lucky that he's just an unbelievably good basketball player. And it wouldn't really matter. You know, you or I could train as much as just as much hard work as LeBron James on the basketball court. We're never going to be LeBron James. We're never going to have that level of success. There's another really interesting element, which is that he's lucky to be born in a place, in a time that values that skill set. So if he'd been in Renaissance Florence, people have been like, well, we mainly like fresco painters. So,
that's 400 years prior, being very tall and strong in America.
It's not,
you're not playing basketball.
Yeah, it's an absolute disaster.
You'll be working.
You know what I mean? Like, so there's sort of like, it's a happy coincidence of timing and the skills that you've ended up with through genetics and then your hard work. Can I finish just by giving you, I think it's an interesting thought experiment that you might like. This again is from Michael Sandel. He's sort of talking about the fact that obviously a big factor in this is higher education and the universities that people go to, and they're such a an indicator of subsequent life success by various metrics. And so the access to those higher education institutions is obviously quite important. He's talking about America, and he's sort of talking about Harvard, and he's like, okay, so you look at Harvard, and they've had, you know, over the years all sorts of issues around diversity, of course. They've tried to improve that. But someone flippantly at Harvard once, sort of one of the admissions tutors said, yeah, we get 40,000 applicants for 2,000 places. And then we have to sort of try and work out who the most deserving, the most able, the most impressive 2,000 of that 40,000 are. And he's like, it's really difficult. And I wonder if I just was walking down the stairs with the 40,000 applications and then I just sort of tripped and dropped them all, and then just picked up 2,000 randomly, whether that would be a less able cohort than the ones that we've painstakingly selected. And Sandel says, probably not, and that is a much better way of doing it. And you can then sort of extend that. So literally, you don't say, we're just going to take the best and brightest. You say, look, if you're, realistically, if you're applying to Harvard, or you could apply this to, you know, like any of the sort of Russell Group universities here, for example, you're going to be smart. You're going to be doing well. Like, you probably do have the aptitude and the ability to do well at that university. So why not just have a sort of lottery? This is our 40,000 applicants. Maybe you have to get rid of a few of them who've actually, like, you know, they've chanced their arm a bit and actually wouldn't be able to do it. So you end up with 30,000. Then you just do a lottery, and you take the 2,000 that come out of the lottery, and off you go. And it's kind of, and I absolutely, like, having been to a sort of well-respected university, I think that's just such a great, it will never happen, but it's such a great idea. And it would remove that sense of entitlement that people have. That's the other thing. People feel like they're such the fucking big man. When they go to places like that and they carry that around, like, I've done so well on my merit to get into this prestigious university, and aren't I fantastic? And it's not a helpful attitude. And I think if you'd said,
it becomes very insular, and it means that people will. But at the same time, the difficulty is that the prestige that comes alongside being in those circles means that might allow your meritocratic drive to atrophy, because just by putting an Ivy League university on your resume or CV, you're probably predisposed to be respected a lot more and maybe not have to go into the lottery for later employment opportunities. I would say, personally, I would go so far as to say is that, like, while the chance the lottery would be an effective and much more egalitarian way of determining entrance, I think the issue would probably be that a human necessity like education should be democratized and I think someone, and many people have said it, education should work the way that American sports does. So you have a draft. So the most successful teachers and most insightful teachers
go to the worst places.
So then what would be then is that if you had the ubiquity or the availability of education for anyone who wants to get it, who shows aptitude in various places, if they could all know they could go wherever they could go to, basically through their own merit, realize the height of their potential, we'd probably see a lot more fairer landscape when it comes to, like, education. And so for me, that's how I'd say it, is that instead of, like, the lottery of everyone to get into Ivy League, work towards every university being Ivy League, and remove the snobbery from going to a particular university. And then that would mean that in turn we'd have to remove occupational hierarchy. And I say this in the view that in the next generation or so, occupational and educational hierarchy is going to become relatively obsolete, because the more that AI begins to proliferate, doesn't matter how smart you are, we'll know that there's someone who can do the job better than you can anyway. And human beings having work making that a part of who they are, or deriving self-esteem because, well, I'm a Harvard educated doctor. Well, when we get to the point where you can perform surgery in VR, or a AI can do an assessment of a human being or a physical, how effective is that going to be as a doctor? So I think, yeah, there's other ways in terms of the human condition and how we can celebrate our attributes are probably going to have to change in the next generation anyway.
We'll be back after this.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to the show.
I'm going to extend Rick's question into my question.
I realise I've taken a lot of time there. I'm sorry.
I don't need to ask a question because, you know, we can just have the discussion. So it's all good.
I'm approaching a particular time in my life, you know, one of those times where people start to make a big deal out of the year of how old you are.
Uh-huh. 50?
Yeah. It's been interesting kind of contemplating it a little bit because, you know, I don't know. I don't really think about it. And it made me question, not want it to sound too bleak and dark here, but sure. Question the merit of my life how much merit I would apply to my life. I've got two young children, Rick, and, you know, fucked with your perspective of the world.
You should talk about them on the podcast.
Yeah, fuck yourself, mate. They're really interesting. That guy who talks about his kids. Yeah, well, they're inspiring, you know. Anyway. So I'm posing the question to you guys because I'm questioning the own merit of my existence. What kind of merit do you give your existence at this point? Look, you could still have more merit, by the way. It's not over your lives, as far as I'm aware.
That's good if you classify that.
Yeah. Why the fuck are you alive, Rick Edwards?
No, but as in, you know, I don't know if either of you got anything. I'm supposed to have a health check. It might turn out I've not got a long left, so this is it.
Yeah, but, this is the peak of your merit.
Questioning my merit. Quite sad.
I had a sort of a definite wobble around this during, as I think an awful lot of people probably did, during the was it the first lockdown? I think it was first lockdown, maybe second lockdown, during the pandemic. And I wasn't working at all. And I just really struggled because I don't think I'd ever properly engage with how much I get identity wise from working, and how intrinsic a part of my character I feel it is, and like the self worth that I have comes from work. And it was tricky, and I'm glad that I had the opportunity to sort of think that through, because it didn't feel particularly healthy. And I think I did get to a point where I sort of realigned my priorities so that I probably feel a bit less like that now. But it was a good reckoning to have, because I don't think you want to just be gauging your merit in direct correlation with your with your work, which I think is probably what I was doing.
Dangerous thing. A lot of people do it.
Yeah.
Very dangerous.
Particularly in this sort of industry, I think. It's,
yeah.
It's so, because everyone's so, what everyone is doing is so visible and so in your face. And you've got like, it's so hard not to compare to others and wonder if you should be doing better or earning more money or getting better reviews or, you know, whatever it is. And it's hard to escape that. So the sort of, you know, whether you want it or not, the feeling of competing with how other people are doing in their lives, whether that's work or outside of work, it's hard, man.
Yeah. Well, and so you have a, not to be, you know, well, you can just tell me to fuck off, but you've got a sweet gig, right?
With your radio show, right?
That's I look at anyone who's in your line of work and go, that's a sweet gig. Like, that's like a thing that you kind of have a great ownership over your radio show. And you think, how many days of the year do you do it? A lot, I imagine.
Yeah. So it's pretty, well, it's Monday to Friday every week, really, which is the first time I've never had that security before. And that's definitely a part of the sort of the reckoning that I had, was part of the decision making process. I was like, I think maybe a bit of stability, security,
structure. People love a bit of structure, and creative people are shit at structure.
I've never had anything approaching structure before, and I'm sure you haven't either, Dave. Like, and
no, you go so long without it that you have to learn that, like, if you try to live a life where you're trying to follow things by a linear trajectory, that can also compound any kind of depression or angst you have, because that's, again, you try to seek that stability by maybe looking comparatively at other people's lives or other people's trajectories, and every time you try to emulate that, then can always have disastrous results.
Yeah. So, where do you rank your life merit at the moment?
Merit life. I guess I don't, and this, I don't necessarily mean that in a fatalist way. I just try to look at it in a much more, much more spiritual way. In that, I think all of the existential problems or angst I have come from trying to compartmentalize my own life rather than looking at it as me being a part of an experience. And I guess I try to have this disposition because comedy is such a solitary art form, and it's very easy for you to look, like you said, in comparatively at every opportunity someone else has is one that you've lost. But I always try to think of what I do. And like you said, that we work in an industry whereby your personage is very much linked to what you do. And so when you're not doing it, as human beings, particularly in the developed world, we have linked occupation with purpose. And so if your occupation is stalled or you lose it, for whatever example, it'll make you think you don't have a purpose. And like I said, the pandemic probably produced that in droves amongst people who were like, I've got nothing to do if I haven't got a job. But at the same time, I said, I think I've done a lot of, been pondering in terms of how relevant work is and how relevant it's going to be as people. And for me, I try to look at life like love as well, as a human phenomenon, as an experience. Like, I'm the culmination of two people's lives. And so, you know, sometimes when I think about my own life, I try to be mindful of the fact that, you know, as much angst as I have about my life, for example, two people sacrificed theirs in order for me to have a life. So I try to look at it as more of a experience rather than something that I hold onto myself. And obviously both of you being parents understand that your lives are no longer just your own, and your purpose is no longer just linked solely for your own spiritual or psychological or physical gratification, because now there is a dependent, and the way you live your life largely influences how this person's life is going to be. So,
I mean, the first thing I say is, you know something I don't know, because I haven't got any kids.
Have you not got kids? Oh,
no.
Howard's got two. Sorry.
You can have one of mine,
Rick,
if you want.
Yeah. Rick, give Howard his kid back.
Yeah, sorry. Like the kids.
Although that being said, Rick, you may not have biological kids, but at the same time, your presence in television for many years has probably influenced a lot of people with a very similar aspiration. And again, how you've probably lived your life has influenced other people who've seen, you know, Rick is from a similar background to myself. You know, very similar in mannerisms, and so I want to work towards doing the same thing. Like, even with me, with comedy, it's kind of been like now seeing another generation of comics that are coming up, whether they're based from Southeast London, whether they are Black British comics. I'm aware now that my actions have probably had the influence on them as well. So again, I don't say it with any lament. Like, I understand in many ways my life isn't my own. My actions have an effect on others. My presence has been as a result of other people's, and probably have had an effect on other people's lives. So I guess
it's a good answer.
So the merit of my life, really, and for lack of a better expression, is to contribute to being a brick in this wall. Like, you know, I don't know where we necessarily are in terms of the story of human evolution or human civilization. And I don't know if 100 years or 200 years people will remember my name or what I did, but at least there are maybe things that can't necessarily be compartmentalized or labeled that make up human ideology that I might be able to contribute to. Even things as little as down to how you love somebody and how people see that may influence how people choose to express their love and humanity moving forward. So
I really love the idea that the historians in the future will look back on the early 21st century and they'll call it the Baptiste era.
I hope not all of it's the Baptiste era.
It's not necessarily an era you want to claim.
Some people are like, actually, according to some historians, Dane Baptiste actually loved Matt Hancock, and I would be there to defend myself. So my conduct can outlive it. But yeah, I think at the same time, it's very important for you to wonder about the merit of your life or your purpose. Yeah. I think
I've got some semblance of an answer to it, of how to define the merit of my life. Maybe yours as well, but you can disagree.
I don't mind, Howard, because the tarot cards ain't working, so someone's got to tell me.
I kind of think it just comes down to a really easy version of events, really, which is just how many good times did you actually fill your life with? And I know that is a kind of quite loose phrase, good times, but like, you know, I like to think this is a good time with you guys, and I like to think the people listening to it, it's a good time. And I'm very lucky that I get to do this with you guys. I equally had a drink with a couple of mates on Saturday night, and we had a good time. And then when my son wakes up at 5 fucking whatever in the morning, and whilst for a period of time I am not full of good times, I still get a laugh out of him and mess around with him, and, you know, we talk about how Hey Dougie's going, and I give him as what I can do at that time in the morning. And you kind of think that really, you know, across all of those different bits of your life, from work to, you know, home to family to friends, it's probably all it's really going to be worth, isn't it?
I think there's a sort of, I wonder if there is a distinction between sort of the merit of your life and your sort of overall happiness, because the merit of your life, I think, is probably quite hard to define. But happiness feels like the only sensible sort of ambition for anyone in a way. It seems really sort of like an obvious thing to say, but I do think it's true. Like, at the end of the day, what do you want? You just want to be, you just want to have a nice, like you say, you just want to have a nice time. And other people around you have a nice time.
Yeah, for a good time, not a long time, is what they say. Yeah.
And we talked a little while ago, I think it was with Michelle Ackerley, about our mums. And I, you know, I often think about my mum in these scenarios because, you know, she would have a very limited professional resume or credentials with which to define the merit of her existence. And yet every single person that knows my mum would say she's the greatest person.
Yeah.
And she's a loving person who gave her life, made everyone who came into her life was you know, happy and touched and felt love from her. That merit is, you know, undervalued in a world of consumerist capitalist bollocks.
Yeah.
That seems to drive our entire species nowadays.
Up until this point, Howard. So
yeah, of course, mate.
But you know, I mean, it's all subjective, and I think the problems in terms of determining purpose and merit of life probably come from our need to compare other people's parameters for success or for happiness, because there's it's like the way I remember it is before I started doing comedy, I remember I was looking for a new car, and I was looking for a different cars to lease, and I was looking at an Audi A3, and which doesn't really matter, but it was like, this might be the level up from the car I have. Mm-hmm. But then the existential question popped in my head is, where are you going to drive it to? And I think that basically germinated into a larger question where it was like, it doesn't matter what the vehicle is, it's where you're going, because uh-huh. they're going to end up the same way. And, I've tried to use it on stage to describe the, I suppose for me, the futility of class snobbery, in that if we're on a plane, if human beings on a plane, or we're on, or on a trip, you have a plane, you think of that as society, it has high technology, and there's a first class, there's a business class, and there's an economy class, and the majority of the laity are based in that class. However, wherever you are sitting, and even though you might get trickled down different resources compared to people in higher classes, if whoever is guiding that plane isn't in the best or habeas corpus or in the best condition, the whole thing goes down. Doesn't matter what class you're in. And I feel like, yeah, I try to apply that to life. And at the end of the day, this is what no one's been able to work out, whether it's economists, capitalists, or scientists. Like, no one's worked out what people say when they come back after they go. And so, which is why it's like, you'll never be able to harness or own this stuff. It's only the experience you can have. And so, yeah. I guess the merit is, again, like merit of your life or purpose in your life is the same as meritocracy, that it, for every individual person, it's all going to be subjective. And what we need to create, I think, really on a social or larger global or social level, is the space to respect everyone's human merit. And as long as it doesn't cause any harm or loss to any other sentient life form, then that space should be for everybody. And we'll probably work it out as we're going along, which is probably our more natural biological inclination to do that anyway.
Well, it's very good of you to give my question such merit. And
Howard, you are matter, and you matter.
Thanks, man. It's your question time, Dane. Before we wrap up this excellent episode.
Well, I don't even know if I had an additional question on top of that, because I don't even know if Rick has kids or not. So I clearly have done my research today.
Any parenting tips, Rick?
Listen, I have a sort of paternal vibe, don't I?
Yeah, exactly. So, I'm sure that's the case for many people. With that being said, we've listed the number of your plaudits, and I think you definitely have had a very visible influence alongside a lot of your colleagues in the shape of British media and popular, and how popular culture appears in media. Especially, I think with like things like T4 and Pop World, they definitely shaped the minds of my generation, and will have done for successive ones. And my question to you, with that respect, is how with the emergence of like influencers and the like what do you think the merit is of the role of being a presenter nowadays, or like a video jockey is, in the advent of like social digital media now?
Well,
do you think it's a more to expand on it, is it a lot more obsolete? Because I think like growing up, like seeing something like yourself or like Makita or Steve Jones or June, like people would head to that as like, you know, what direction that their eye should go in terms of looking for emerging trends within popular or music culture. Whereas now that's become a much more saturated, or I guess democratized position to have in popular culture.
Yeah, and I think there's a real range of people sort of fulfilling that function now on all many different platforms. You know, if I think about when I was starting out, it was pretty much if you could become one of the get very lucky. This is a great example of getting very lucky, I think. If you get lucky and you somehow become a TV presenter and you manage to not be shit at it, then you could just sort of keep going, because there just weren't many. Wow. Just weren't many presenters, not that many jobs, but enough to sort of keep going. So if I think about my direct peers, the people that I was sort of in competition with, or I didn't particularly feel like that, it's like a handful. It's like 10 people, maybe, if that, who would be going up for the same kind of jobs that I was. And now that is probably still true, but there's so many other avenues for people to kind of do something similar. And I do think I would emphasize similar rather than the same, because I think when I've worked with YouTubers and stuff in the past, and I think that they are. It's such a specific skill that they have, and it's not the same as the skill of a presenter. And I think sometimes that gets exposed because it feels like it probably is the same, but somehow it isn't. So I couldn't be a YouTuber, I don't think. I guess I'm definitely not going to be now. Would I have been if I'd been born 20 years later? I don't know. But it doesn't feel like something I could do. And YouTubers, by and large, I can't think of an example where this isn't true, have struggled to make the transition to be a TV presenter, even though a lot of them want to do it, which to me always seems a bit bizarre, because on YouTube, you have absolute ownership and agency over everything. You can earn a shit ton of money and have a much bigger audience than you would presenting most TV shows. And yet somehow TV still has this kind of cachet. But it doesn't translate as well as you would think. But then they do have, I think, probably a more obvious responsibility because of the sort of nature of what they do. Like, they are influencing people. Like, that is what they're trying to do, is influence. And whether that's selling a product or an attitude or a kind of way of life, whatever it is, that is their, you know, that is the goal, whether it's stated or not. And that wasn't really the case when I was doing T4. We were just sort of, maybe we just didn't really give it any thought particularly, but we were it was a new
aesthetic then. So you probably weren't as focused on what today would be called key performance indicators or indicators of success. It was like, you know, we're talking to cool bands, having fun, meeting other like-minded people. And I guess, you work out. And maybe that's the reason why, you know, YouTubers, people are still aspiring to do it. And even though they still have aspirations for TV and stuff, is that because there's been an aesthetic was kind of created there. And so when people think of themselves as a presenter or an aspiring presenter, there's probably certain elements of the work that you used to do that people aspire to. In the same way that I've seen comics who, for me, as far as I've seen, they've got like 5 to 10 times the followers I have online, but they want to do Live at the Apollo still.
Yeah.
Rites of passage and communicators. I guess in terms of someone's self-image, when they are imagining themselves as a certain type of person, whether it's a presenter, to them it's like, part of that would involve the milestone of being on terrestrial television. YouTube, I guess it's because the barriers to entry are so low. Finding distinction within that space is a lot harder than if you were on TV, where, you know, there's a lot, like I said, it's meritocracy is much harder to realize when there's a lot more walls and adversity in a space. As opposed to the democratic aspect of social media, while it means that more people can have a voice, it's in the same way that, like, you know, human beings, democracy gave us aristocracy, because when everyone spoke, we all, I guess, collectively decided it's better that we have representatives that speak on our behalf rather than us all doing all the talking. And maybe it's the same with, like, YouTubers and the like, is that at some point there'll be some kind of aristocracy that exists. Like, it does really with, like, blue ticks and stuff. If you have a verified account, that carries a lot more weight than you just being a random person online, I guess.
Yeah. And obviously I just pay for mine now, but yeah.
Oh, you got to now. Yeah.
But the thing about the democracy element of it all that kind of confuses me is, I definitely feel, and this could be because I'm aging significantly, but, like, I definitely feel that the roots of kind of, like, progress, you know, like human progress, like, there would be a consideration in some people's heads that reality television was in some respects a route of progress in the, let's call it the noughties. I guess you could probably say it came about earlier than that, but the noughties was the era.
Baptiste era, please.
And, you know, reality TV.
2000 BC is also fine.
Yeah.
You know, reality TV had like a real, you know, it was a really remarkable thing for a period of time. Shows like Big Brother, Super Nanny, Wife Swap, to name a few, were like very, very, you know, pertinent. And people talked about them a lot. It was kind of quite shocking to see our world reflected back at us. Now, that kind of marketplace is not, I mean, what's the word for the most saturated thing in the world? Like, we have oversaturated everything to the point that watching someone open something they bought online is a form of reality that you are engaged with on mass levels, millions of people. So at some point, and maybe I'll be proved wrong, I imagine there's going to be a kind of unraveling of this democratization. There's just going to be like loads of people sitting there going, why is no one watching anymore?
Yeah, it's very hard to kind of unpick whether that is us being older, because I just my big fear is that you sort of, and you see it so often with older people basically saying, well, I don't really get what this thing that these kids are into is about. And I don't think that is any sort of marker of the quality of the thing. It's just sort of gradually getting disconnected from.
Sure, but like, you know, I'm going to push back a little bit there. Like, you worked on a show that for our generation, Tool Academy, was like an iconic bit of television. And the moment that happened in that show when the blokes realised they'd been stitched up was fucking TV gold at the time it was made. It now feels, and I think you'd agree, quite a cruel thing.
Something
about Miriam that came on Sky was much worse.
Tool Academy is an example because Rick, but also can I just say on that point
we're not talking derogatively in a derogatory fashion about Miriam. I hope you're able to continue living your truth wherever you are.
Sure. It was a fucked up show is what we're saying, you know? The Tool Academy thing, it was like, you know, at the time, you know, people were quite legitimately like, and were, it was massively entertaining. And now we wouldn't get away with it, right? So then my argument would be like, in a period of time, people, you know, opening boxes and it being deemed acceptable, probably as the climate crisis increases, that'll potentially heighten this problem. You'd be like, why would we deem that acceptable?
Well, it could be, I see you're saying, Howard, but I think what Rick says is that, like, because of our detachment from a certain mannerism or ideology or trend, that could be, you know, part of our age. Because I have also pondered what people get out of that. But then I would say to consider, if you are a child who knows, it's much more likely that you won't get gifts at the behest of your parents or as any suppliers, but you can be a part of the experience of seeing someone opening a gift after 12 years of horrible austerity, where the prospect of getting a present yourself is impossible, celebrating somebody who can, it's all we have left. In the same way that, like, you know, some of us, we celebrate when people win the lottery, even though we're not getting a penny ourselves. And, you know, it's, I think, so a lot of these strange experiences that we see online, like watching someone else play a computer game or watching somebody else open a gift or someone else try on clothing, I think it speaks more to, as you said, Rick, that there's a large disconnect that has obviously come from our migration onto social media as human beings. And maybe we haven't been able to make the link yet, is that the reason why we like some of the more banal things we see on social media is because that's the aspects of the human experience that we're missing. We're missing being with somebody when someone goes, oh shit, look what I got for my birthday. And you go, oh, that's amazing. And then you go, can I have a go on the bike? Me first, but then you can go. Like, these, like I said, these are small minutiae of life. Whereas, like, watching a friend open a computer game and turn to you and be like, let's play this shit right now, bro. Yeah. Like, this is what we're kind of missing on, because we've become so much more individualistic and isolated.
Mentioning the winning the lottery thing, I think is really interesting. Sort of to go slightly back to the what we're talking about with happiness, because I came across, and I don't think this is a coincidence really, during the pandemic, I came across this a lady called Laurie Santos, who's a psychology professor at, I think it's at Yale, it's somewhere like that, and she does a class at Yale that's all about happiness, and it's the most subscribed class at Yale, and she puts all of the lectures online as well, and it's massively popular. And she also does a podcast called The Happiness Lab, and she started doing it because she kind of anecdotally noticed, or felt that she was noticing, that her students were getting less happy. As in the individuals, but as she went through the years, she felt like the cohorts were getting less happy. And so she started to look into it. And so she just talks about what makes us happy. And one of the things that she looks at, obviously, because it's the sort of first thing that you think of, is, does money make you happy? And it's really interesting because she found an awful lot of people who've won the lottery and it's absolutely ruined their lives. That's the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And they wish they hadn't. And also did a really interesting sort of study where they said to people, you know, at various levels of the sort of income ladder, how much more money do you think you need to be happy? And as you go up the income ladder, that amount gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So effectively, the more you earn, the further you are away from your... and she basically says that there is a huge difference between going from poverty to not being in poverty. So money, of course, has a massive influence on happiness up to a point. And then after that point, which isn't particularly high level of income,
I heard it's like 80 grand and your happiness doesn't increase over that.
Not at all. If anything, it will start decreasing because you sort of almost like the stress increases.
Yeah.
And I think it's such a useful thing to have in your mind that money, no matter how much we're sort of almost programmed to believe it, money is not the thing. It is up to a point and then it just isn't.
And it won't be. Imagine the other side of the echelon, that the people that have almost all the money, they have to think about how much they have to invest in disseminating the idea that this does make you happy, because if not, we'd have nothing to respect them for.
Yeah.
And the whole purpose of their being would be removed. And that's one of the reasons why you hear lottery winners say, oh, I'm still going to work. Because a large part of their life's merit, working towards winning the lottery, whether in a syndicate or writing numbers, has now been removed by them winning it. So it means a large part of how they probably spent their lives no longer exists. And that's why they're like, I still got to go to work, because if not, what else do I do?
Yeah, what am I doing?
Yeah, because I sound like I socialised, because I used to hang out with other people that played the lottery. Oh, yeah. I used to be at the bingo hall, and I can't be around those bitches anymore because I got all this money. So, yeah, you could definitely be a prisoner in that respect, I guess.
If you have won the lottery and are listening to this show, good luck to you and, you know, get in contact. But otherwise,
put some money to support our NHS midwives and staff. You'll feel much better.
You actually would.
Altruism is really good. You can't put a price on it.
It's been a hell of an episode, Dane. It's been a real big, wide ranging, deep and meaningful.
I think that Rick Edwards has come and planted some seeds, and it has germinated and bloomed into a wonderful bouquet of flowers. Not only have we given you flowers, Rick, you have produced some of your own. Thank you very much for being a guest on the podcast.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry if it was a bit heavy in the end.
Not at all. There's no need to apologise. It's called Question Everything. There's no small print that goes, but keep it there, please.
Yeah. So, anything you've done wrong, Rick. The only thing you've done wrong is apologise.
Yeah. Okay, I'll take it back.
There you go, exactly.
But listen, love to the kids, Rick. Yeah. And,
one day that's going to make sense. When the historians look back in the Baptist era, they won't be able to pick out a proper lineage. They'll be like, not only was he an ideologue, but a prophet in Rick Edwards' case. Thanks again, good sir. Where else can we find out about your good works, past, present, and future? Where you're up to?
I'm on Five Live, BBC Five Live, every morning, 6 till 9, so feel free to listen to that. Or you can listen to my podcast, which is Eureka, which is basically me and my friend, who's a quantum physicist, very smart man, just sort of discussing any science question that might take our fancy. So it's quite... It's what I love about it is the range... Because it's just, you know, exactly like this, really. You can talk about anything. It's your podcast. You do what you like. So we do everything from, you know, should we be trying to make contact with aliens to, you know, we just did one recently. It was like, why is science so white? Which is quite heavy. And then we did, you know, will we ever talk to animals? Just all over the place. But in a good way. And it's kind of, the idea is... It's a science podcast, but you don't need to be like a science geek to like it. So we sort of try and do it.
You don't need to be a geek to like it, lads.
Yeah,
At the real quantum of the discussions, everyone can understand how the world works. So
that
sounds
right.
Good. So our listeners, please do check out Eureka when you can. But in the meantime, check out Rick Edwards at all good places where oration is taking place. Rick, thank you again.
Right.
It was good to see you, good man. And again, I'm genuinely grateful for the personal hookup and all the support up to now. So great to see you.
I will continue to support you, and thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste and myself, Howard Cohen. For more from Dane and myself, make sure you follow us on Instagram at DaneSnapTeast and at The Howard Cohen. You can now support us on Patreon. Just search DBQE Podcast and unlock ad-free content, and you can watch the full-length video of the podcast. Please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a question for Dane, make sure you send us a DM on Instagram at DBQE Podcast, and we could feature you in our next episode. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Insanity Group.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.